This is a segment from The Annex, an academic sociology-themed podcast. For more, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com. All right, so I'm here with, well, not physically here, but I'm speaking with Nicole Bedera. And Nicole, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, so I'm a doctoral candidate in the sociology program at the University of Michigan. And right now I'm working on my dissertation, which is about how one particular university, not the University of Michigan, is handling sexual misconduct complaints on campus. So my research focuses largely on masculinity, sexual violence, survivorship, all of these things together. Before coming to grad school, I used to work as a victim advocate. And so that's where a lot of my perspective comes from, is the hours that I spent in hospitals with survivors immediately following their sexual assaults.
First of all, can you give us any preview of the findings, or are you going to wait for the big reveal? Can I get a scoop?
Well, I wish that I had more to tell you, but I started my dissertation 3 months ago, so it's new. But so far, I can say that there are a lot of varying experiences with sexual violence on college campuses and sexual harassment. Things are changing. The Me Too movement is having an effect on what leads survivors to make claims of sexual assault, formal claims, to either their universities for a formal process, or even just feeling like they are entitled to some kind of recourse and some kind of services. And the University of Michigan has a victim advocacy office. And for the first time, they have survivors walking into their office, not needing a referral, who are thinking, this is something that's not okay, and I want to handle it. So that's been exciting to see, even in the first few interviews.
So I reached out to you today on, I think a few hours ago, on my commute home. I was on Twitter, and I came across a thread you wrote, and you exploded today, huh?
Yes. Yes, it appears that I did.
First of all, what's it like? What's it like to blow up on Twitter?
It's weird. It's really great in some ways. And it feels awesome to be able to make that kind of an impact and have people listening to what you have to say. But it's this is the second time that I've had a tweet go pretty viral. The last time it was just about academics, you know, needing time off and how important it is to rest. And that, you know, comes from my work as a sexual violence scholar. I cannot think about rape 24/7.
Yeah.
And so that tweet was a lot less contentious than this one, which is about the Kavanaugh hearings, and it's about rape. And there are a lot of studies on the thread that are full of bad news that people don't want to hear. And so it's been a mix of really great things and, you know, obviously a little bit of harassment and stuff like that as well. But overall, I'm thrilled that people are listening.
So this is 12 hours old, this tweet. And I loved it. And I reached out to you immediately because I just think this is so what good public sociology does, right? You're marshaling a ton of facts and giving like a nice informative picture about sexual violence and reporting and a lot of the issues that have been raised with the Kavanaugh confirmation. And I thought maybe you could just walk me through your thread and, share through audio what you shared on Twitter for those of us who aren't connected to Twitter.
Yeah. So to give some context, I'm pretty active on Twitter, but I've had a hard time figuring out what to say about the Kavanaugh hearing and all of the sexual assault allegations coming forward, because a lot of the conversations around it seem to sort of just be missing the point in terms of what I know as a sociologist, the studies that I've read. It felt like the talking points from both sides were not quite what I would have wanted, and that there were some fun.
Sorry, can you give us some concrete examples? Like what in particular did you come across that you just didn't like or thought was off the point?
Yeah, so there are just some fundamental misunderstandings in the public sphere about sexual violence. And that's really what I wanted to address. And so these are things like whether or not false allegations are rare or common, how common it is that sexual assault happens, how many young men are committing acts of sexual violence, why survivors might wait to come forward and whether or not that has any bearing on the credibility of their claims. These are really basic things that we talk about in sexual violence scholarship across disciplines, including sociology. And a lot of those basic facts were just missing in this case.
So I think you start off by talking about how common it is for young men to commit acts of sexual violence. So how prevalent is it?
Yeah, it's really prevalent. So usually when we talk about prevalence rates, we talk about victims and how common victimization is. But there was a study that came out a couple of years ago that had better methods, just objectively kind of better methods than other studies about perpetration. And they found that about 10.8% of young men commit an act of rape before graduating from college. And so that's way higher than we thought. We've always been hearing, you know, it's less than 2% of men, and it's actually closer to 11% of young men.
How did they figure, like, they, first of all, this is 10.8% of men. Is this a self-report? Do you remember? I don't want to put you on the spot.
I taught this class. I'm teaching a class on sexual violence at a liberal arts college this semester, and this was their assigned reading for today.
Oh, awesome. Coincidentally. So it's like hot off the presses. Okay, good. I don't want to put you on the spot. But is that, so wait, so really it's 10.8% of men are willing to acknowledge that they've committed some act of sexual violence.
Yes. And those surveys, you know, they don't just go out and ask, have you ever committed a rape? Are you a rapist? Because people, there's self-report bias, right? People are concerned about social desirability and they're not going to say yes to that. That and the vast majority of rapists, even incarcerated rapists, do not believe that they've committed an act of sexual assault because they engage in a rationalizing process where they rationalize away what they did and they say, this is okay. I've seen this in my own research. I'm working on a project that's in its kind of early stages right now on interviews that I did with young men and the way that they talked about what false allegations are and what counts as rape. And they were making distinctions like there is a difference between rape and non-consensual sex. This is that rationalizing process that we're talking about where the definition of rape just gets smaller and smaller. So if you ask men just explicitly, are you a rapist? They're going to say no for a lot of reasons, even if they are. So this study instead uses behavior-based surveys where there's a long list of survey questions that describe things that meet the legal definition of sexual assault. And the findings for this particular study focuses on the types of sexual assault that are also classified as rape. So those are things that include penetration.
So we should give a shout out. Who authored the study?
So it's a nice big group of people who've done a lot of work on sexual violence for a long time, including Kevin Swartout, Mary Koss, Jacqueline White, Marty Thompson, Antonia Abbey, and Alexandra Bellis. And so this group of people really have been working on sexual violence for a long time. They are the foremost experts in this area of prevalence rates in particular.
Why do scholars think men commit these acts?
Well, so there's kind of this perception that men who commit acts of rape are really hateful. But in fact, it's true that sexism is a good predictor of sexual assault perpetrating behaviors. But it seems like the better predictor, especially of kinds of sexual harassment or what we might consider to be less severe forms of sexual assault. So the stuff that Brett Kavanaugh was originally accused of, that's still bad, but it's not a completed rape, but it's absolutely still traumatizing. Those things are done to let men look masculine to each other. And this is really especially common among young boys whose masculinity is not very well established yet. And so in the case of Kavanaugh, this helps us understand why there are witnesses all the time and why there are other people in the room and why he might be trying to impress specifically Mark Judge.
So in effect, the events that are being described by Kavanaugh's accusers, these would be events that men would do together and the woman is being used as an object, basically.
It's a way to bond. It's a way to exert dominance and power as a group. So the study that I cited there is by Beth Quinn, and the study is all about men who would engage in what she calls girl watching. So they were sexually harassing people at work, but often the women didn't even know that they were being sexually harassed because it was really just something for these men to talk about and for them to be able to bond in some way.
There's a lot of talk about minimizing the impact. And your thread talked about normalizing sexual violence. What's the process there?
Yes. So sexual violence just kind of is normalized in our society. And a big part of that is that we just see it as boys will be boys, and this is sort of what should be expected. And most girls have had experiences with some form of sexual harassment or violence before they even graduate from high school. And that is horrifying. But because it's so normal, we tend not to think of it as harmful. Even if it is harmful, people will minimize the harm, including survivors themselves.
So wait, but just because they normalize it doesn't mean that there's not lasting effects, right?
Right. There are absolutely lasting effects in cases of sexual violence, particularly if a survivor who really needs resources, you know, the effect of sexual violence, it depends survivor to survivor. Some people are not hugely impacted, but some people are devastated by things that a lot of us would think are not particularly serious, like a harassing comment or an offhand touch, something like that. But in the cases where it is really traumatic for survivors, that trauma doesn't go away. And in fact, if you don't address it, or if in trying to address it, somebody engages in victim blaming behavior, or they are not helpful in giving you resources, telling you that you don't deserve those resources, then the trauma can be intensified. And it can last for a really long time. So it's important that survivors get access to resources when they need them, when they want them, and that they're just kind of available and ready, regardless of whether or not they're ready to report the sexual assault, because in some cases, it's really hard to report. In my own research, I have done research before my dissertation with queer survivors of college sexual violence. And one of the papers that we're just starting to work on now as we're analyzing the data is about the way people responded when the survivors told stories of what happened to them, or the people who they were afraid to tell because they were afraid of what they would hear. And in one case that really stands out to me, the survivor we interviewed told her mother that she had been raped and beaten by her boyfriend and that she wanted to go to the police. And her mother actively discouraged her because her boyfriend's dad was a powerful judge. And she did not want that to be happening in their community. She didn't want that scored on their family. And so she paid off her daughter to keep her from reporting. So there are a lot of reasons that survivors don't report, including that they're pressured not to by the people who they first speak to. But yeah, it doesn't change the trauma.
What are the kinds of support and resources that help?
Yeah, so we know that talk-based counseling really, really helps. And there are a lot of different kinds of therapy that's trauma-informed and intended for survivors. Also, there's just some kind of basic material stuff, like not having to see your perpetrator all the time and being able to get a successful no-contact order. Like if you don't feel safe in your home, having the ability to move or stay in a hotel or whatever it is to be able to feel safe and comfortable. Victim advocacy offices on a lot of campuses and rape crisis centers in a lot of communities have very long lists of resources that are available for survivors. And the reason for that is because sexual assault impacts your entire life. And so some of the things that you need are fairly basic and material things, like having a safe home, being able to switch jobs if you're being harassed at work, things like that.
Right.
And other things are more about the cognitive imprint of trauma, and that's mostly therapy.
So I want to switch gears a bit. A lot of Kavanaugh's defenders are arguing that this is a political smear and that these are false allegations, that they never happened.
Yeah.
And we often hear that from the research tells us that false allegations are not very common. How common are false allegations?
False allegations of sexual assault are about as common as false allegations of any other crime.
Okay.
The rates are almost identical. So there have been a lot of studies on the topic of false allegations because it's something that politically we really care about. And those studies have found rates between 2 and 9% of allegations are false, but most of them have been on the lower end of that distribution. So we can comfortably say that the vast majority of survivors are telling the truth.
And then you said in passing that, first of all, I loved everything you wrote. I thought it was, again, just great public sociology. And I think a lot of non-sociologists are really going to appreciate being able to read what you read. But you told me that there was a lot of negative reaction too. And yeah. What was the negative? Well, first of all, what's controversial about any of this? I'm a little bit at a loss to see the controversy.
I think sociologists we're often at a loss. Sociologists were always at a loss about why our work is controversial, because we're looking at data and facts, and we know where this information comes from. We're creating it. We know what happened. And so it is surprising that it's controversial. But I think the reason that it's so controversial is because the ramifications of this thread are clear, and they're kind of intimidating. Like, we need to take on the way we think about masculinity and fundamentally change it. And the other thing people don't like is, we're used to dismissing survivors of sexual assault and saying that they're false allegations. And if we start to take things that we've counted as false allegations as, oh, those might be true, then that affects our favorite celebrities are going to turn out to be sexual assailants in a lot of cases, especially our favorite athletes, people who we know and love and care for, who've been accused of sexual assault. We might not be able to brush that away as, oh, that person was falsely accused. It's kind of amazing. I've done interviews with young men about affirmative consent and how they feel about consent policies. Mm-hmm. And I was shocked by how many of them had stories of, well, my friend was falsely accused, or a friend of a friend was falsely accused. When in reality, those accusations were probably accurate. And it's just really hard to imagine that out of your friends, the people who you're in relationships with. You know, maybe it's your husband, boyfriend, spouse who's been accused, potentially a wife, but we know that men are most often the perpetrators of sexual assault. Or it could be, you know, a really close friend. And I always end up telling the story of the first study I ever really did. I was an undergrad. It was my undergraduate thesis at my tiny liberal arts college. And
well, why don't you give it a shout out. Give your college.
It's Westminster College in Salt Lake City, and now I'm teaching there as adjunct faculty, and it's fantastic. And I really am loving it.
The homecoming.
It's wonderful. And when I was a student at Westminster, I was really disappointed by the level of discourse around sexual violence on college campuses. And to give you some context, I started college in 2010. So this is a few years before we started talking about college sexual violence again. You know, we talked about it in the 80s, it went silent, and then it came up again in 2013, 2014. So I was on, you know, one of the students who was feeling this unrest of, we see this problem and nobody's talking about it. And I wanted my administration to take it seriously. So for my senior thesis, I did a prevalence survey, very similar to the one that was used in the Kevin Swartout and the rest of the author's piece. But they have one for victimization. And I conducted it on my campus and then gave the rates to the administrators, gave it to the faculty, presented it anywhere I could find it, because I wanted people to know that sexual violence was a serious problem on my campus. And in giving all of those presentations, a lot of survivors came up to me and told me their stories, and many of them named names. And in this process, I identified three serial rapists on my campus, and two of them were close friends of mine.
Wow.
And so I tell this story because it's so uncomfortable. It's so uncomfortable because often the men that can get away with sexual violence are really charismatic. They're often very powerful. They're people who are likable because that's why we can turn the other way. That's why when we hear whispers about what they've done, we say, that can't possibly be true. He's such a nice guy. And so a lot of us are really close with people who've done really unspeakable, horrific things to women in their past. And that's what's so uncomfortable. That's what makes this thread so controversial, is it's so close to home.
Well, I thought it was a great thread. I thought you did. It was just terrific. So congratulations on these 15 minutes. I'm sure there'll be many more 15 minutes to come.
Thank you.
You want to give a shout out to your committee, or do you have one yet?
So I don't have a formal committee put together yet, but my advisor is fantastic, and her name is Fatima Mugabe Gosick. And additionally, all of these other scholars at Michigan who have really shaped the way that I think about things, including Elizabeth Armstrong and Sandra Levitsky, who are working on a giant project about Title IX right now. And then I want to give a massive shout out to my undergraduate advisor and now very dear friend, Chris Jane Nordmeyer, who's the one who got me thinking about this stuff in the first place.
All right. Thank you very much. That's Nicole Bedera from the University of Michigan. She's a doctoral student and she studies adolescent sexual violence. Thank you for joining us, Nicole.
Yeah, thank you so much.
For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.